Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, Dickinson College using waste to produce energy and trusting news on this election day. But up front, Russian-backed cyber criminals are targeting American hospital and healthcare providers' computer systems with malware and demanding ransom payments to unlock information and data networks. That warning came from the FBI and two other federal agencies last week. In the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, hospital and health systems in at least six states have been under attack recently. Information that includes patient and treatment histories and medications have been put in jeopardy. Ransoms of up to $12 million have been demanded. What can be done to prevent these attacks? Joining us is Bruce Young. He's an information security executive and a cybersecurity and information assurance lecturer with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Bruce Young, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk at WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I'm going to start with some of the basics. What is ransomware?
So ransomware, it's a type of malware, and it's very sophisticated in the fact that it will encrypt data if it's able to infect an environment. And what that means by encrypting data is that to the normal user, that data is unreadable or unlegible. And it's encrypted with keys. And unless you have those keys, you're not able to decrypt or encipher the information. So regarding healthcare, that could be someone's, you know, protected health information or PHI information.
Maybe I should take a step back and define malware. I mean, I think a lot of people have an idea of what it is, but what exactly is malware?
So malware is a type of computer code that may have different functionality. It's a way for bad actors to try to infect a computer system with a code, sometimes referred to as a virus, that will do different types of activities. It may allow a bad actor to take control or get access to a computer system. In the case of ransomware, the code will run and will then try to spread throughout an environment, getting access to as many files, folders, systems that it possibly can, in this case of ransomware, to basically infect or make information unavailable to the users.
Now, we all, those of us who use a computer, are on the internet, especially for business or for work, have been told or warned over the years, don't open an email if it's from someone you don't recognize, because this is one of the ways that a network can be infected. Are there others? What are some of the ways in which malware and thus ransomware can get into a system?
So there's usually two components to an infection. There's an attack method, and that attack method, the most common one that you just described, usually is related to phishing. And phishing is where the bad actors are trying to send an email that looks like a legitimate email that ultimately will get the user to take some kind of action, which may be to click on a link, that's embedded in the email. That link then will execute the code, and that code, as we talked, is that malware that then installs itself and will then can execute. So the attack methods most common are phishing. There's also what are referred to as a drive-by. A drive-by may be where you're simply just out going to different websites, and those websites are compromised or may have been compromised, and the host of those websites may not realize it. And some of the indications then, once you go to a website, it may pop up and say that you need to install something or update your JavaScript or your Adobe. And then by clicking on that link, it then will install and activate the malware. So those are the two most common that for the normal user environment where they could experience those different types of attack methods.
So those two that you say are the two most common, are those one of the ways in which these bad actors, as you call them, get into a hospital or a healthcare system or a government system, something that is a large network?
That's the most common. Phishing is definitely the most common because it has what's referred to as the largest attack surface. If they are able to get all the email addresses of an organization, then they can try to launch a campaign, right, to try to get as many, you know, emails into that organization, because they know that it may just take one individual to click on that link. Bad actors, though, being very sophisticated, that they may also just try to attack or come into an organization through other vectors, like being able to attack their websites and to try to get access in, and they themselves launch the malware internal once they've gotten within an environment is another way for the infection to occur.
What are some of the signs that a system has been infected by ransomware?
So generally, you know, the most common thing is just that the files will become inaccessible. So if you don't have the tools and techniques to detect that changes have occurred on a system, the first indication is usually when users start to try to access their files, or a system or application is trying to access files that have now been encrypted or unavailable, that they'll start to recognize, and calls will come into the service desk, and users will complain, you know, I tried opening my file, the data's, you know, not readable. If you have, you know, some of the security controls in place, you can detect if files have been changed, and or if files now are appearing in folders and directories that don't belong there. Those are some of the code that may be running, or sometimes they even, as part of the ransomware attack, will actually leave instruction files in the folders or directories that have been compromised, to basically alert that, you know, what you need to do, kind of the payoff, you know, what do you need to do to get the keys or the, you know, pay the ransom in order to get your data back.
Okay, so that's let's focus on that a little bit more. I mean, eventually there is some type of communication with whether it's a hospital, healthcare system, government entity, anything, that there will be some kind of communication that here's what you need to do to get this data back, correct?
That's correct. For large types of attacks against, you know, a healthcare organization, they're ultimately looking to get some type of a payout. They're hoping that the infection will generate, a large disturbance in order for the healthcare institution to provide services. So the larger the impact that they're able to have, the more likely that they can get the organization to make that payout. So they will leave instructions on, you know, how to contact or what to do in order to make that payout. And now, even with more sophistication, they'll start to set timeframes that, you know, if you make the payment, you know, within the next 24 hours, it'll be this amount. And if you don't, and it's 48 hours, the amount goes up. So the longer that they're able to have an impact, the higher that price. You mentioned, you know, millions of dollars. So the longer that it takes for an organization to recover, the more effective the ransomware event has actually been, and they can scale it to try to get more of a ransom payout.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this segment of the program is Bruce Young. He's an information security executive and cybersecurity and information assurance lecturer with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. We're talking about there have been a spate of, ransoms that have been demanded of hospitals and healthcare systems across the country over the last month or so. Some in the millions of dollars, and the FBI and two other federal agencies have warned that Russian-backed criminals, cyber criminals, are targeting these institutions in the United States. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. All right, so one of the big questions is, what can someone do to, and I say someone, that's more than just one person in most cases, do to protect against ransomware?
So an individual, certainly they want to make sure, just like an organization, that they have the security protections for the user component. That means some type of an endpoint protection system, making sure that you have antivirus, anti-malware capability through some type of a product or service that ensures that your device does not get infected. For organizations which have a much broader infrastructure that they have to protect, there's several different ways that they should be protecting that environment, especially healthcare organizations. Not to be too technical, but they too should have endpoint protections and perimeter type protections of their environment and infrastructure, things like, you know, firewalls and more of the technical security controls that are designed to protect their environment from malware and ransomware infections. And certainly to be notified and have a response plan in place so that if an alert goes off, that they're immediately able to address the situation. For a simple user, that alert then hopefully comes from their protections that they have put in place. We mentioned about being vigilant and through phishing attacks, being aware of your email that you're opening up. If it's not from an expected recipient, don't open it. Don't click on links. Delete it immediately. Make sure that you have some type of spam filter that will filter out any of the emails that you're not expecting or that may come from unknown sources.
But I would imagine that hospitals and healthcare systems, anyone that has a fairly large network, that they would have these protections in place anyway. So, but it's still occurring. There still are those miscreants who are able to get through and to infect a network. So how do they do it even if there are protections in place?
Well, unfortunately, sometimes the protections may not be configured correctly, or healthcare, costs are very high. In cybersecurity, it's really just a relatively immature things when it comes to healthcare organizations, making sure that the protection of health information needs to be a priority. Many healthcare institutions, they don't have someone even at the highest level. Like many organizations will not have like a chief information security officer. So it really just hasn't made its way up in the priority. It does take resources to ensure that the proper protections are put in place, and that the controls are configured correctly, and to ensure that even the security controls that exist within the system are configured to only allow access to the information to those individuals that need to do and perform their jobs. Ransomware spreads usually by the user account that has been infected. And so if that user ID has more access than what they need within systems, then the virus is able to spread throughout the organization to whatever that user has access to. And so by making sure that proper permissions are set on applications and data, can help prevent the spread of ransomware.
Why hospitals and healthcare systems? I don't know whether you heard
me. Sorry.
My question was, why hospitals and healthcare systems? Why have they been targeted?
I'll go back to one of the successful breaches that occurred back in 2016 with the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center, which was one of the first healthcare organizations that made the news of getting impacted by ransomware. Their systems were down for what's been reported as 10 days, and they ended up having to pay the ransom in order to get their data and systems back. And so that really set a precedent that it identified, one, that healthcare organizations are what are referred to as soft targets, that they don't always have all of those necessary security controls in place, and that they are easily acceptable to ransomware attacks. With the Hollywood Presbyterian incident, the reason they weren't able to recover from it was that they didn't have proper backup and recovery processes in place, so that they couldn't even restore the data that had been corrupted. And so ultimately it was less expensive and impacting for them to actually pay the ransom. So that set a tone throughout the healthcare field that hospitals are soft targets for ransomware attacks.
Can this ransomware be traced? I mean, the FBI said it was Russian-backed cyber criminals that are targeting American hospitals and healthcare systems. Can they be traced? I mean, we've all seen the crime dramas on television or in movies where someone is kidnapped and what law enforcement does to try to, trace back to who actually has done the kidnapping, find them. Can that be done? How easily can it be done when it comes to ransomware?
So generally when you're talking at that level, the tracing back is usually done by determining the type of ransomware. They put names to the ransomware and usually can trace it back by just kind of the signature of the type of ransomware. One of the sophisticated things about ransomware attacks is the fact that they don't usually take the data, that they don't have to remove it from the environment. And that's where if they remove it from the environment, early on ransomware attacks, the attackers were actually taking the data and keeping it more hostage by removing it from the environment. But with more sophisticated ransomware, the data stays where it is. And so they're not extracting it from the environment, because when they extract it, they now have ownership of it. And that ownership could then lead to, if it's found, could trace it back to the actors that have it. So that's why most of the time it's just left in place. It's just unavailable to the users. Another way, the payment method is usually done through cryptocurrency. And cryptocurrency is very difficult to trace back, but law enforcement can try to trace back through the payment method if a ransom was paid. But again, oftentimes very difficult to trace back, but most commonly trying to identify the fingerprint of the type of ransomware would lead to, the Russian hackers in this example.
And obviously one of the things that's different here is that the people who are doing this aren't looking for identities. They're not looking for personal information. For the most part, they're not looking for medical information. They're looking for money. Bruce Young is an information security executive and a cybersecurity information assurance lecturer at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, talking about this today and the FBI and other federal agencies making so many American institutions aware. Hopefully they will act on it and make their systems more secure. Mr. Young, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Dickinson College is known for its Center for Sustainability Education and initiatives to reduce the school's ecological footprint. Dickinson is one of the first institutions to sign the American College and University President's Climate Commitment in 2008. By signing, Dickinson pledged to adopt a climate action plan that would lead to carbon neutrality. Being carbon neutral happens when the activities included in their carbon footprint add zero net emissions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. The college is one step closer with a plan to put food waste, cow manure, and brewery residual grain to use, powering their farm and adjoining dairy. Joining us today is Matt Steinman, Assistant Director of the Dickinson Farm. Mr. Steinman, welcome to the program.
Hello, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And Ken Shultz, the Associate Vice President of Sustainability and Facilities Planning. Mr. Shultz, glad to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you very much. Excited to be here.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. 1-800-729-7532. Matt Steinman, tell me a little bit about this. First of all, explain that, if you would, provide some background on Dickinson's farm, the farm that will be powered with this waste.
Super, thank you. So we have a 90-acre property up there in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, Cumberland County, and the farm is both an educational program and a working farm. We grow certified organic vegetables on 10 acres. We have grass-fed beef and lamb, and those products are serving the campus community as a food source. And then we're also providing lots of educational resources to the college, field trips, independent studies, research, et cetera. Beyond that, we're a function of campus sustainability. So we compost all of the food waste from the campus, which is about 1,000 pounds per day during a normal semester. The interest in using that food waste resource as an energy source came about 5 years ago as we started studying it as a feedstock for anaerobic digestion. We've been doing small-scale waste-to-energy demonstrations there at the farm since 2011, but really got serious about 5 years ago and realized through a feasibility study that we could actually make enough energy to power the farm with this material.
So, I mean, this is kind of a self-sustaining thing in that you use the food waste, the manure, cow urine, I understand, and the excess grain from brewers, that you use all this and it can produce enough electricity, enough power to produce more food for students, right?
Sure, exactly. So there is a lot of energy in waste. Anybody that's ever had a home compost pile has probably seen steam rising from the compost pile or a manure pile in the wintertime. So that's one way that the energy can come out of waste. Through an anaerobic digester, we will capture that energy as a through a pathway that's called a methane generation. So microbes will convert the waste into methane and fertilizer. The fertilizer comes out, and we can still use that on the farm. But the methane, we capture it, and methane is the main component of natural gas. So in our small-scale system that we have now, we capture the gas and burn it as a cooking fuel. So we run the farm kitchen on sometimes on cooking fuel from the digesters. But when you have enough of it, you can actually run it through a generator and make electricity. So this system will generate about 300,000 kilowatt hours per year of electricity, and that's renewable electricity offsetting greenhouse gas emissions. And that will power both our farm, the neighboring dairy farm, which is participating in the project, and that's Triple L Dairy Farm. So we'll power both our farm and their farm and still export about 200,000 kilowatt hours per year to the MedEd utility.
That MedEd serves your area at Dickinson. Now, one thing I want to ask you about, though, some listening to this, they will hear the word methane and think, well, that's a greenhouse gas. What about that? I mean, yep. How do you keep that from becoming, you know, something that adds to a carbon footprint?
That's a great question. So when methane is released from the front or the back of a cow or a landfill directly to the environment, it is a greenhouse gas. But if you can combust it, it then becomes carbon dioxide, which CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but that will be released by the decomposition of these materials anyway. So we are just jumping in there in the middle and hijacking the energy, so capturing that energy source. And yeah, it is our responsibility as people that are generating now more methane through the anaerobic process that we don't release that to the environment. So to be good stewards, we need to make sure our system is tight and leak-proof. But we're building a professional commercial-scale system with engineers and such, so we're confident that we won't be releasing methane. We'll be combusting it and offsetting combustion of fossil fuels. So this is actually that's a renewable source.
Okay, so you said that the school started this in the mid-2000s, got serious about it just a few years ago, but what is planned now is a biodigester. Talk about that.
Great. So our system will be a 375,000-gallon tank. It's about 40 feet diameter by 12 feet high, and that tank will have mixers in it. And so we will collect the food waste from our campus and the manure from 150 dairy cows at the Triple L farm. and push those waste materials into pits where it will be ground by high solids like chopper pumps, and that will provide a steady stream of waste going into the digester on a daily basis. There, it's mixed and kept warm via heat of the engines that are running on the biogas. The gas naturally is produced by microbes in the cow manure. So there are archaea, which are like bacteria, in the cow manure that when they encounter food waste and cow manure feedstocks, they can generate methane and carbon dioxide. So the gas collects at the top of the digester tank, and then it directly feeds to our engine, which will be generating the electricity. The heat of the engine goes back to keep the digester warm, keeping it out cow body temperature. We're trying to run, it's kind of like an artificial stomach or an artificial cow intestine.
That's a nice thought, I have to say. Our guest during this portion of the program is Matt Steinman, Assistant Director of the Dickinson Farm. Ken Shoulders, the Associate Vice President of Sustainability and Facilities Planning, talking about using food waste, cow manure, other waste to generate electricity and power the farm. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ken Choldis, you're the Associate Vice President of Sustainability and Facilities Planning. How does this fit into Dickinson's overall sustainability plans?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. It fits in perfectly. It's like a perfect project that fits into our carbon neutrality initiative. So the college became carbon neutral last year in our fiscal year 2020, and we're one of the first 10 colleges in the U.S. who have accomplished that. So we've put together a lot of projects since we made this target and this goal of becoming carbon neutral in 2007, and this project really represents a climate action plan project for us, which is a project that reduces carbon emissions and gets us to our goal of neutrality. So the beautiful thing about this project is not only is it reducing carbon emissions that we're emitting into the air, but it's also a great project that's improving the water quality, our local water quality, because the digester facility is going to be a more environmentally friendly way to handle storm sewer kind of issues, stormwater issues that are going into local creeks. So by capturing the manure, we're preventing it from going into the local waterways. And so it's a water quality project, it's an air quality project, it's a land quality project, because we're diverting these waste products from going to the landfill. So this food waste, if we weren't composting, it would otherwise be going to the landfill. So it's a landfill diversion project. And then I think Matt mentioned, but we're really excited too, because we really look forward to introducing the project to other local farmers in the area, because we think it's a great project for them to implement on their farms too. So we think it's scalable. It's got financial benefits too, because we won't be paying for electricity off of the grid. We'll actually be producing it, so we'll be avoiding those costs. And of course, we look forward to wrapping the whole thing into our educational mission, which we do with all of our climate action plan efforts.
I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but for farmers who use manure for fertilizer, what are their alternatives if they're not using manure?
Okay, you mean for digestion?
No, I mean for putting on their fields. What are they using?
So farmers need some sort of fertility in the field to keep their crop growing. And so a lot of farmers use manure. They also, if they're a conventional farm, they will buy a chemical fertilizer, ammonium nitrate, that sort of thing. As an organic farm, we also use, we can buy like dried seed products and things like that. And then we do a lot of cover cropping, which is where we plant alfalfa and such, and plow them down to feed the soil as well. So there's a wide variety of things. We've been doing organic farming there at Dickinson for over 13 years now, and we don't really fertilize that much with manure. It's mostly we're fertilizing with compost made from the food waste and with a few
So yeah, I was going to mention the other way to do it is with the food waste, which we've been doing for quite some time. We compost that and use that on the field. So,
So Ken, I want to get back to being carbon neutral. As you mentioned, from your fiscal year 2020, that Dickinson has been carbon neutral. By the way, I don't know. This may be a dumb question. Is there such a thing as carbon surplus?
Yeah. Yeah, there's such a thing as being net positive in terms of your carbon footprint. So that if you're net positive, that means you've not only mitigated all of the emissions that that you're generating, but you're also producing carbon-free energy and putting that into the system. And so in that sense, you're actually net positive in terms of emissions. So there is such a thing, yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, so for those who may not know how Dickinson became carbon neutral, how did you do it? I mean, this is one way to just kind of complement that carbon neutrality, but what other ways did Dickinson become carbon neutral?
Yeah, so we put together a climate action plan. So that's really a plan that specifically provides identifies projects that will reduce carbon emissions. It identifies how much it'll cost to do those projects, and then how many, you know, the amount of emissions that you'll mitigate from the project, and also almost always it's kind of a great thing. These projects reduce utility costs too. So anytime you have a climate action plan project, it almost always results in financial savings, usually by cost avoidance for utilities. So we. We actually brought students, faculty, and staff together and had a committee that came up with a climate action plan for the college, and we did that shortly after we made this commitment in 2007. And we've actually we've done two climate action plans since we started. And so we've identified projects into categories. So there's four main categories that we identified in our original climate action plan, which will mitigate carbon emissions, and they fall into conservation projects, which are like behavior projects, which don't really have to cost anything. It's just trying to get the overall Dickinson community to change their behaviors to be more sustainable, which could be as simple as saying, you know, kind of a whole campaign to turn off your lights when you're not in the room. Just, it can be that simple, or to reduce, you know, just to reduce your energy in that way. So there's conservation projects, there's efficiency projects, which are projects that make systems on campus more efficient to reduce energy. Renewable projects, and the college has done some really exciting renewable energy projects. And the biodigester project's an example of a renewable project, but we also have a 3-megawatt solar field on campus, which produces about 30% of our electricity for the college. So we've done a number of great solar projects, and the last is offsets, carbon offsets. So at the end of the day, if we can't reduce all of our emissions through the projects that we're doing on campus, we can invest in a project elsewhere and through investing in those projects, we can essentially buy renewable energy credits or carbon offsets to reduce our emissions. So those are the four broad areas. There's some other details I could get into, but let me pause there and switch it in.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. Impressive what the school has done, and I'm sure that there are other institutions out there trying to emulate what you are doing. Ken Shultz is the Associate Vice President of Sustainability and Facilities Planning at Dickinson. Matt Steinman, Assistant Director of the Dickinson Farm. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Today is Election Day, and between the pandemic and millions casting votes by mail, it will be unlike any we've ever experienced in Pennsylvania. WITF and other media organizations have had to adapt. WITF's multimedia news director, Tim Lambert, is on Smart Talk today to talk about trusting news. Tim, welcome back to the show on this Election Day.
Always great to be here, Scott.
So what should we expect tonight?
Patience. I think patience is the biggest thing to expect. I think that a lot of results will be coming in from the in-person voting that's happening at the polls across the state right now. But there are a lot of mailed-in ballots that need to be counted as well. Some counties, at least seven, will not start counting them until tomorrow. So I think a lot of patience is in order for tonight. And just sit back and just try to stay in touch with what's happening. But you're not going to have a result from at least the presidential election in Pennsylvania tonight.
But will there be numbers coming out tonight from those that the votes that have been cast by those in person?
Yes. Yes, there will be numbers. The state will be updating them as they come in throughout the night. But again, we will, as we report those numbers, we will be adding that that note of caution that these will not be final numbers. And there is still a long way to go in tabulating the state's vote this year.
You know, and Tim, I may be asking you a question that you can't answer, but I'll ask
love
it anyway. Yeah, I know. But, you know, on a normal election night, we'll hear that, you know, 25% of the precincts have reported. With so many mail-in ballots, will we see those kind of percentages of how many voters or what percentage of voters have their votes have been counted in a precinct?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think that some of these votes haven't even been. I think the canvassing was allowed to start at 7 a.m. today. Once the polls open, then counties can go through and start pulling out the from the envelope that we've heard so much about, the secrecy envelope, the naked envelope. I think the naked ballot. So I think that is when you're going to start seeing some of those results coming in, but percentage of voters, I'm not sure we'll see those tonight. One thing to keep in mind, again, with the mail-in ballots, we know that 3 million mail-in ballots have been requested and more than 75% have been returned at this point.
All right. So I ask about what to expect tonight. Everything is unprecedented when it comes between now and Friday, when the state says that you know, the mail-in ballots have to be in if they're postmarked by today. Do we know what to expect? Have any idea what to expect between tonight and Friday?
I think we will be seeing some counties counting faster than some of the other ones. Not sure which ones will, but they did have a practice run during the primary in June that was moved from due to the pandemic that was moved to June. So this is a much larger undertaking, and I think counties will be taking their time. But we'll see counties run the gamut. Maybe some will be in tomorrow. Some counties are confident that they'll have that are starting the count today that are confident they could have numbers tomorrow. It could be Friday. It could be Saturday. A lot of this attention on Pennsylvania is going to hinge on how some of these other battleground states roll out. If it looks like Joe Biden's path is going to the presidency comes right down to Pennsylvania, or President Trump needs Pennsylvania as that firewall to secure re-election, then the scrutiny on the count becomes a little more across the country. But we may see results from other states tonight that let us know who the next president is going to be, and that will take some of the pressure off the vote here in Pennsylvania.
All right, here's we have a question from Virginia. It says, with everything being so divided, we often hear that we should rely on reliable sources. What would they be? A conservative might never believe that the Washington Post would ever tell the whole truth about an issue. Conversely, a liberal might never believe that Fox News would be telling the whole truth. One must spend a lot of time researching quotes to get the whole quote. Listen to both sides of an argument to form their own opinion, and unfortunately, not many have that time. So how do you address that, Tim?
I think there's a subtext to that as well, because you're comparing the Washington Post, which is digital print, to Fox News, which is a news organization on cable television, but it also has a very large audience through its opinion shows. So there's a difference. You have to make that difference between Fox News journalists, and they have some very good journalists at Fox News, but there's also the opinion side that sort of has the louder megaphone at Fox Fox News. So it's hard to compare those two. But this goes back to just kind of looking at the best practices of an organization. What rules do they follow to ensure they publish accurate information? Does the journalist or organization have a list of rules they follow? How do they check their facts? Who funds them? What is the organization's mission and priorities? Does the organization make corrections? And if they do, do they have a corrections page you can see the transparency that they have? Do they have that commitment to diverse, accurate reporting? How do they show that they're sticking to the rules? That takes a little bit of work on the part of the person who's trying to find the facts and find the proper context. But in this environment, with so much misinformation and disinformation and partisan reporting in some circles, you have to do a little bit extra homework. But you want to look for those organizations that are very transparent in what they do. Do they have their ethical guidelines? Do they have their editorial guidelines posted that you can read them? And do they show their work? Some journalists explain the process of reporting and all the documents. We read X number of documents. We talked to X number of sources, and they lay it out and show the listener, show the reader, show the viewer exactly what went into their reporting in a particular story.
Another question, what are we doing, WITF, to keep our journalists safe while they're covering the election? And I think this is probably a question, when we say safe, from the pandemic, from the coronavirus, and also, unfortunately, there is the possibility of maybe some violence or voter intimidation or, you know, some of the things that we hope doesn't happen, but is potential out there, has potential out there. So what are we doing with WITF's journalists to keep them safe?
One of the things, as far as the pandemic goes, our reporters are going to practice social distancing. They will be wearing masks. Some will double up on masks. We have issued KN95s to some reporters that were able to come in and pick them up before the election. And they might wear a piece of cloth over top of that. Well, they also have, for their microphones, a sort of boom mic that'll extend to 6 feet so we can practice social distancing while interviewing sources. We will follow the same sort of guidance that we have throughout the pandemic when our reporters are in the field and just hope for the best and hope that they follow those guidelines and take good care of themselves as well. And I think we have a team that will do that. Now, if it comes to any sort of intimidation or threats or potential violence, our reporters have our numbers, have an attorney's number, also will be notifying us if they are in a situation that they don't feel safe, and we will try to get a second person out there, a third person out there to kind of watch their back as well. So it's going to be a fluid situation. We hope, along with everyone else, that cooler heads prevail today and people just exercise their right to vote in a peaceful manner.
Tim, I'm asking you to put your journalist hat on right now.
I always have that on, Scott. Come on.
It's permanently glued to your head.
But
this early in the morning, the polls have only been open for a few hours. Have there been any issues across the state? From every source that I have heard, voting in person has been very heavy this morning. Have there been any problems?
I haven't seen any. I haven't heard of any from our team that is in place, and we are in seven counties today. But we are monitoring situations. The only thing I have heard, just like everybody else, long lines, which is expected, and which is something we did expect, that the polling places will be filled up, you know, for the most part. We'll see if that cools off a little bit throughout the day and picks back up at noon, the normal work hours when people have a chance to go vote. But we'll see if that remains heavy throughout the day. But the expectation is that there will be a heavy presence in the polls today. People will be waiting for their turn to cast their ballot.
And not only will they be long because there will be more people voting, but also because they are distanced, supposed to be distanced by at least 6 feet in line, the lines could stretch out the door and around the block and even appear longer than what they normally would. Tim Lambert, want to thank you very much for being with us today. I know Election Day is always a long day for you and all of WITF's journalists, but encourage everyone to tune in tonight and get the latest on what's happening in Election 2020. And, Tim, thank you very much for being with us today.
Anytime, Scott. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, and this is a bit of a tradition, day after election, we have political analyst and pollster Dr. G. Terry Madonna of Franklin Marshall College on the program tomorrow. Again, it's going to be different. Normal circumstances, we would have results. We'd be talking about those results. Tomorrow, we may be talking about what trends are or what we saw across the state today. So Dr. Madonna on tomorrow's program. Get out and vote. Talk to you tomorrow.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein & Lear.